702 and Cape Talk.
The Naked Scientist.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us again. And you have a really interesting story here about clever crows.
Good morning. Yes, I spotted this one. It's in the journal Scientific Reports. And a friend of mine works on crows, and so it immediately caught my attention because these are really clever birds. Nikki Clayton, who's my friend, she calls them feathered Einsteins because they are able to solve problems that no one would have thought that an animal of this tiny size should be able to solve. This new paper shows that these birds are even brighter, perhaps, than we had given them credit for. What these researchers do is they show the birds a food reward, which is inside a box, and they can reach the food reward through a slot, and they have to hook it out with a tool. But what is crafty about this experiment is that the tool isn't long enough to get to the food. So the birds know they've got to use the tool, potentially. They know that the food's in the box and they can possibly hook it out, but they don't know how to reach it. What they can do, though, is that the tool is carefully crafted so that if you take one piece of it, you can connect one piece of it to the next piece of it, like a telescope, making a longer tool. And you can then thread this longer tool in through the slot to hook out the food item. Now, the birds have never been shown this. They don't know any of the pieces of apparatus. They don't know how to solve the problem. They've never seen anyone else solve the problem. They put 8 birds into the experiment independently, and half of them realized that if they took each of the pieces of the tool and slotted them together to make a much longer tool, then they'd be able to reach the food and retrieve it. Now, why this is amazing is that not only are these birds planning for their future, they're able to say, well, if I do this, then this will happen. They're able to visualize something which doesn't even exist yet, a longer tool, and visualize making a longer tool from 2 shorter pieces. Now, that really is very clever. And, you know, most little human babies would not work that out until they're quite a bit older. So it's really impressive that these birds are able to even do this in the first place. It's even more impressive that they can solve these sorts of problems that even human children wouldn't solve initially.
This compound tool making is something that we didn't predict was a capability of birds and birds like this. One of the interesting things that I always remember thinking about is just the migration patterns of birds and how they sort of know their way around. But now we're learning that they're even able to sort of make these more complex tools.
I mean, it is impressive when you look at nature, isn't it? I mean, but the migration maybe is slightly less so, because the thing is, these birds' lives depend on that. So they have had millions of years of evolution to help them. It's not immediately obvious why having this incredible reasoning ability should have been endowed upon these birds, though, because their lives don't depend on being able to think several steps into the future to make these sorts of tools. Or maybe they do. We don't know. It's obviously something that's evolving actively, but we don't know why they're so good at doing this. I mean, this isn't the first experiment of its type. There were some scientists in Cambridge, where I work, who did a similar experiment a few years ago, where they put the birds in a cage, and they had a worm in a tube that the birds could see, and the worm was floating on water in the tube. But the birds couldn't reach far enough down into the tube to get to the worm. But next to the tube was a pile of stones. The birds didn't know that they could use the stones, but they very quickly realized and worked out that if they picked up a stone and dropped it into the tube, the water level went up a bit. And if they did this lots of times, the water level came up far enough that they could then reach into the tube and get the worm. And more often than not, the birds would learn to solve these problems. So why they have this ability, we don't know. But they certainly have extremely advanced reasoning ability and planning ability.
Really interesting mysteries. Makes me wonder whether I'd be able to solve that if put in a high pressure situation.
I hope you would be able to. I hope you would.
I think I'm gonna stick to the broadcasting and the writing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that makes Tervis.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you have any thoughts on this really interesting revelation about the complex intelligence and this new study about crows being able to use compound tools and figure their way how to actually put different parts of tools together to achieve a goal, please give us a call. You know the number in Joburg. It's 011-883-0702. And in Cape Town, it's 021-446-0567. And as ever, Chris is very graciously also going to answer any of your questions and try to satisfy your curiosity in various ways. Chris, I had a question for you, and I wonder if you could satisfy my curiosity before we get to the calls, which I see are already coming in. It's this question of sleep. We laugh a lot in South Africa because some of our parliamentarians are prone to napping at crucial times in public debates, and we have this term sleepist for people who sleep in parliament. But actually, I've been reading Dr. Matthew Walker's, who's out of Berkeley, a new book on the importance of sleep and some of the mysteries of why we even sleep, and just breaking this myth that a lack of sleep is actually something to pursue, whereas in actual fact, we find that sleep debt actually impairs us a lot. Should we be sleepists?
Well, I wouldn't advocate being a sleepist and, you know, missing important debates. But the fact is that if you look at most animals, they sleep like we do. And the fact that so many different species over evolutionary time have prioritized sleep, we spend a third of our lives doing it. And if we don't do it, it's possible to go mad, or in the case of small animals, to die if you are not capable of getting enough sleep. Then, as a result, it must be very important. So for some reason, evolution wants us to sleep. Now, some people argue that the reason humans go to sleep is because sleep coincides with nighttime. Nighttime's dangerous because there are things around that could eat you. So if you make a person drop off, go to sleep and hide in a nice cozy bed at the end of the day, you're less likely to get eaten. So there's one advantage to going to sleep at night. But of course, some animals are active at night, so it can't be the whole story. And by delving into the brain, we're getting a better idea as to why sleep is a priority. One suggestion is that the brain accumulates various bits of biochemical rubbish during the day. And this is because the brain is cocooned behind what we call the blood-brain barrier, which protects the neurochemical environment of the brain because it's very delicate and carefully controlled from what's going on in the bloodstream. And when you're awake and active during the day, you're eating and drinking all kinds of things, so your blood chemistry can change quite radically. We don't want that happening in the brain because it might upset the ability of the brain to do its job. So the brain keeps itself away from what's going on in the blood when you're awake, and then when you go to sleep, this special system called the glymphatic system kicks in, opens up various channels, and flushes away all the accumulated rubbish and biochemical waste from your day's activities. So it may well be that part of the important role of sleep is a cleansing process for the brain, washing away all the accumulated rubbish. We also know that memory is consolidated when you go to sleep. It's apparent, it's clear now, that sleep isn't just an on or off state. Your brain goes through various phases when you go to sleep. There are phases of intense activity. There are phases of much lower levels of activity. When you test people who've been asked to remember things and who have been given the chance to sleep after being given these things to remember, their recall is significantly enhanced afterwards. So we think that part of the process of memory consolidation and information consolidation and learning consolidation, that takes place when we go to sleep. And sleep may divorce you from the normal distractions of the day, enabling those memory circuits to lay down the correct footprint, if you like, of those memories, so you remember them better later.
Really fascinating stuff. A lot of your calls coming in. We're staying with the naked scientist, Dr. Chris Smith, as we satisfy your curiosity on a range of scientific questions. We'll be back after a short break. About to hit 20 minutes past 10, and I'm Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh with you on this final day of Standing In. And we're with the naked scientist, Dr. Chris Smith. Lots of your calls streaming in, and we're going to get right to them now to try and satisfy your curiosity on a range of scientific questions. And we've got Werner who'd like to ask a question. Werner, welcome.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Hi. My question is quite a subjective one. I grew up in Switzerland and watching soccer on television, moved to South Africa 13 years ago, and still watching soccer on television, but then started watching rugby. What I notice is that every time the ref blows the whistle, that rugby whistle seems different than the soccer whistle. And I've been really observing in these last couple of times when I watch these different games, these different sports, that in my view, the rugby whistle sounds a lot more subdued, whereas the soccer whistle is more forceful. How can that be? Is it just me? Is it really a subjective matter, or is there actual different whistle they use?
Thanks, I think we need a proper objective test on this, because I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if the whistles used or favoured by rugby refs are different to the whistles favoured by football refs. But if anyone knows the answer to this, any football refs on, and can phone us up and tell us, that would be wonderful. Or just tweet at Naked Scientist, because this is intriguing. It might be that there genuinely is a difference in the whistles used, because the frequency of the sound is going to be a reflection on how big the whistle is, how long it is, and the aperture used to make the sound and so on, because that will affect the frequency. But it might also be where the microphones are around the game, because football can be mic'd up a bit different to rugby. I don't know for sure if it is, but it's possible. And if you mic up an event differently, the microphones that you use and the positioning of the microphones that you use are going to affect the relative way in which the sound is picked up, and that will affect your interpretation of the sound as it comes to you. So it could be all of the above. I don't know the answer. I would love to know if anyone can tell us.
Really interesting. Werner, as a loyal Liverpool fan, I also want to know why the whistle isn't blown when we have a clear penalty given to us, but probably not a scientific question. Sheldon, though, has a scientific question, and we're going to go to him now.
Good day. Mine's quite simple. I want to know why every full moon, the high tides are always plus minus 3 o'clock. It never goes further between 2 and 4. Is there an explanation for that?
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Hello. Well, first of all, why do we have the moon cycle? The reason we have a cycle of the moon, a full moon, a new moon, quarter moon, half moon, etc., is because the Earth turns inside the orbit of the moon, and the moon is going slowly around the Earth, and the moon takes about a month to go from where it starts right the way around the Earth and then back to where it started. So we see different phases of the moon, because when the moon comes up, relative to the sun, we're seeing one side of the moon being illuminated. And depending upon where the moon is relative to us and the sun, we're going to see more or less of the moon's surface illuminated by the sun. And that's why you see different phases of the moon. Now, why does that affect the tides? It affects the tides because the moon is pulling the water on the surface of the Earth closest to the moon towards the moon. It accelerates the water a bit. So you get a bulge of water facing the moon, because the gravitational attraction of the moon on the Earth pulls the water up there, and that gives you a high tide. Now, that effect will be greatest when the moon and the sun are in alignment, because the sun's pulling on the Earth and the moon is then pulling on the Earth, and they're both pulling in the same direction. So you get the highest tides in a month when you have a spring tide with the moon and the sun in alignment, either because of a new moon, the moon is on one side of the Earth, the sun on the other, or they're both on the same side of the Earth. You have a neap tide, the lowest tides of the month, when the moon is at 90 degrees to the angle of the sun. Now, because the Earth is turning inside the orbit of the moon, then obviously you're gonna see, and the moon doesn't take completely a month to go round, then you will find that the moon is moving across the sky a little bit every day. So that's why the tides advance by an hour every day. So they always come an hour later each day. And so the high tide today will be an hour earlier than the first high tide tomorrow, because the Earth is the moon is slowly making its way on its orbit around the Earth. And so the time that the moon's highest in the sky coinciding with the Earth is going to change each day.
Fascinating. Just love your encyclopedic knowledge, Chris. We have so many calls streaming in. We're going to go to Avon, I think is how it's pronounced, in Centurion. Welcome.
Hey, how's it, guys?
Good.
Just coming back to that bird story. I guess if someone calls you a bird brain, it could be a compliment. Eh?
We should hope for that.
Yeah, I think it really would, because if someone calls you bird brain in future, actually, they're saying that you're like Einstein. It's the same as saying fish have a bad memory. Fish have a really good memory. There's a guy called Cullen Brown who works in Australia, where I am at the moment. I think he's up in Queensland, and he did this study about 10, 15 years ago, where he was showing that fish have an excellent memory, and he showed these little fish a fishing net with the hole in the net marked up so they could recognize where they could swim out and escape. And he taught them to find this hole in the net, went away, and then months to a year later retested them, and the fish could still remember how to find the hole very quickly, proving that fish actually have an excellent memory, not a bad one.
Yeah,
so if anyone tells you that you've got a memory like a fish, that's also wrong as well. But anyway, I guess that's not why you phoned in.
Yeah. So my real question is quite a deep one. So it's just in terms of you know, how we've been able, you know, since the beginning of time or whatever, been able to identify species, whether alien or not, in terms of, and I guess it's somewhat relatable to, you know, our knowledge or our periodic table, for example, the 118 or whatever elements of the periodic table. So if we identify a life form, it's, you know, a carbon-based life form kind of thing. So my question is, and I've wondered about it for some time now, is have we, could it be that maybe our mechanisms to detect certain life forms are just not sophisticated enough, or our technology is not sophisticated enough to actually detect something, you know, that could be existing in Earth at the moment, that could be an alien life form, but, you know, we know what we know. So our ways of identifying life form is kind of still backwards in terms of the actual life form that exists. So what I'm saying is, could there be alien life forms that exist on Earth, or even you know, outside of Earth, that we've just not developed the technology to detect them as yet, or the sophistication to detect them as yet? Is that possible, or is it that we've reached a stage where we can, based on our technology, based on the elements of the periodic table, we've okay. been able to identify? Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, the bottom line is that you never say never in medicine and biology, because biology is an amazing thing, and it's had millions of years to work out how to do things. I'm pretty comfortable that most of the major forms of life that exist on Earth, we probably understand them, and we probably know they're here. But there are definitely some interesting and exciting things happening at the margins, and where we don't necessarily think to look first. Good examples of this are that number of years ago, there was this BSE, the bovine spongiform encephalopathy crisis in the UK, where people were feeding the ground-up bits of brain of cows back to cows, and these animals developed this brain-eroding disease, a bit like CJD in humans, which became known as BSE. When people looked into what that was, they realised that it was a form of, whether you can call this life or not, but a form of life, a small protein which is made naturally in the brain, but which had gone wrong in some of these cows and changed its shape. And when you exposed the healthy protein to this unusual protein, it then converted the healthy protein into the unhealthy shaped protein. And those converts could then go off and convert more healthy protein into the unhealthy protein that damages the brain. No one would have believed that you could have a protein capable of transmitting a behavior like that in the past. Another example is that scientists discovered a whole new type of virus a number of years ago. It was enormous. It was so big. It was bigger than some bacteria. So they called it a mama virus, because it was the mother of all viruses. Huge. When they looked even more closely in these viruses, they found these tiny particles, which they subsequently dubbed Sputnik, after the satellite that the Russians put into space, because it looked like inside these viruses there were these tiny satellites orbiting. When they looked more closely, they found that these tiny satellites were in fact viruses which were preying on the virus. So even viruses can catch viruses, and you have these things called virophages. So I think you have to keep an open mind. We always need to be sceptical that we know everything. We don't. Otherwise, we'd all be out of a job. There's all kinds of exciting things waiting to be discovered. But I think we know pretty much what the main life forms are on Earth. I don't think there's anything going on on a massive scale that we don't know about. But, of course, out there in space, who knows? And there are these potentially other dimensions that we don't even know exist, and we can't detect yet, and we can't investigate yet. And if they exist, perhaps there are organisms, perhaps there are entities that can inhabit those dimensions, and we can't see them, but they're there. Who knows?
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Chris. It's been really fascinating stuff as ever, and hope you get some good sleep tonight as well.
Well, I'll do my best. It's very important to get a good night's sleep, of course, as you've pointed out.
I've decided that in order for me to do what crows can do, I need at least 10 hours of sleep.
Well, if you want to go and make a hook out of a stick and get maggots out of the log, then be my guest. But I'll stick to chicken tikka jalfrezi, which is my dish of choice.
Fair enough. It's been great. Thanks again for joining us. And I know you'll be back with us next week with Eusebius resuming regular duty. Thanks so much.